political analyst and author from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tagway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqara, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Tehran summons Norway's ambassador to protest the Norwegian Parliament Speaker's comments on the recent riots in Iran. Palestinian NGOs say Israel is trying to stop them from probing its rights abuses by labeling them terrorist entities. Plus, North Korea says it has no arms dealings with Russia, accusing the US of seeking to tarnish its image with such rumors. Many thanks for joining us. Iran has summoned Norway's ambassador to Tehran over remarks made by the country's parliament speaker against the Islamic Republic of Iran. The foreign ministry condemned as unacceptable remarks made by Masoud Gharakhani during an interview with an anti-Iran Saudi-backed television network based in London. The ministry also censured the Norwegian official for his interference in Iran's internal affairs. In his interview, Gharakhani had encouraged those behind the recent riots in Iran to continue their actions. The Norwegian diplomat said he will immediately convey Iran's protest to Oslo. Iran's intelligence ministry says it has so far arrested 26 Takfiri terrorists in connection with the recent terror attack in the southern city of Shiraz. The ministry says the detainees are nationals of the Azerbaijan Republic, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan. The ministry says the terrorist who coordinated the terror attack is a national of the Azerbaijan Republic. According to the ministry, some of the detainees were plotting to carry out acts of terror in various cities, including the southeastern city of Zahedan. The ministry vowed its operation will continue until all people behind the incident in Shiraz are identified and punished. A gunman entered Shah Cheragh Shrine and opened fire on pilgrims, killing over a dozen and injuring another 21. Daesh terror group has claimed responsibility. Head of London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission Masoud Shajareh says the recent terror attack on a holy shrine in the city of Shiraz was a coordinated effort to destabilize Iran.
Absolutely. What it seems to be very clear to see for everyone is that this is a coordinated effort to use every possible ploy to destabilize Iran. In the same way that the destabilization took place for Yemen, for Syria, for Iraq, and indeed Afghanistan, etc. And the Takfiri element, the use of Takfiri elements and the terrorist group is actually a part and parcel of this plan and plot. Without it, it won't happen. We saw in Libya how that played out and how there was a coordination between the United States and Western powers and the Takfiris and how that was implemented. Equally, we are seeing the same process being done in Syria, and this process is being planned for Iran.
U.S. President Joe Biden on Friday repeatedly disparaged Afghanistan as a godforsaken place a year after the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from the country. The remarks have drawn widespread condemnation from people in Afghanistan and the Taliban. We have a report from Kabul.
U.S. President Joe Biden recounted his trips to Afghanistan in a recent speech to war veterans, including one in 2008 in which he was stranded in snow. In his remarks, he repeatedly disparaged Afghanistan as a godforsaken place. The Taliban say his words are out of frustration.
We don't know on what basis they've stated such a thing, but Afghans continue to live their normal lives. There is no need for the U.S. cooperation and help. Such statements are made out of frustration and envy. In any case, God willing, Afghans live their normal lives and build their country themselves.
People here say nearly two decades of U.S. presence in Afghanistan didn't have any positive impacts on their lives. They say the American forces committed countless war crimes and destroyed basic infrastructure in many areas.
The U.S. has not served any country it has entered. The U.S. considers its own interests wherever it goes. There is no improvement in the lives of Afghans, as you see, and people are poor.
The U.S. was in Afghanistan for 20 years, and now Biden says Afghanistan is a godforsaken country. The main factor to that is the Americans themselves who created disorder in this country.
The U.S. ended its occupation of Afghanistan in August 2021, but shortly after that, the Biden administration imposed sanctions on the country and froze billions of dollars worth of assets belonging to Afghanistan, leaving the country in a difficult economic situation. People say the ongoing war in Afghanistan is an economic one. Many are striving to survive while billions of dollars of their assets are frozen by the U.S. Abdullah Hamirzad, Kabul.
Israel has been denounced for its decision to outlaw several Palestinian rights groups as terrorist organizations. The head of one of the rights bodies told UN investigators that the regime's move was, quote, like an execution designed to stop them from probing abuses. He made the revelation during public hearings hosted by a team of UN Human Rights Council appointed to probe the underlying causes in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israel has harshly criticized the hearings while refusing to cooperate with the team that will also look into the May killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. In October last year, Israel designated six Palestinian civil society groups as terrorists and accused them of financing the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The Israeli decision then sparked widespread international outrage. To discuss this in more detail, we are joined by Mona Kendall. Mona, thank you very much for joining us. Can you give us more details about the ongoing situation in occupied Palestine?
As you were saying, we are speaking about a, let's say, an independent commission established by the United Nations Human Rights Council last year. Well, it started an inquiry, mission of inquiry has begun. Public hearings started from Monday and will continue to for 5 days. They will be searching the allegations, let's say, and the alleged human rights violations in the Palestinian territories. Israel has outlawed six Palestinian NGOs, organizations in the occupied territories. They accuse them of funding and working with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, bringing, members of the PFLP to work in these six Palestinian organizations. We have to mention that Israel consider the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine as a terrorist organization. They continue to arrest their activists and they prevent their activities in the occupied territories. According to Shawan Jabbarin, he is the head of the Legal Aid and Human Rights Group, Al-Haq, and it's one of these organizations. He told the three-member panel yesterday on Monday that Israel's decision to outlaw those organizations and groups as terrorist organizations, he said it was like, let's say, an execution designed only to stop them from probing abuses. The work of these organizations in the last years were very clear. They wanted to expose the Israeli crimes, tell the world about the ongoing Israeli aggression against the Palestinians, going to the areas where Israeli military seize Palestinian homelands, force people out of their homes, taking testimonies from Palestinians, documenting all the crimes. Many Palestinians were killed in cold blood, and they those organizations had testimonies from, let's say, family members, and they brought witnesses in order to prepare, let's say, cases to take it to the International Criminal Court. This, of course, had angered the Israeli regime, and that's why the Israelis had been doing their utmost in order to stop the work of these six organizations. They didn't find anything but to say that they are terrorists and they fund terrorist organizations in the Palestinian territories.
Mona Kendall, thank you so much for joining us. Moving on now, North Korea has rejected as groundless U.S. claims that Pyongyang is supplying arms and munitions to Russia for the war in Ukraine. Pyongyang says it has never had arms dealings with Russia and has no plans to do so in the future. It says rumors of arms dealing with Russia are a hostile attempt by the U.S. to tarnish the image of North Korea. Last week, Washington said artillery was being delivered from North Korea to Russia under the cover of shipments to West Asia or Africa. Meanwhile, Pyongyang has denounced the UN chief for his, quote, unfair comments on the country's recent missile launches. The North said the tests were counteraction for self-defense to cope with the U.S. military provocations. Antonio Guterres has condemned the launches, calling on Pyongyang to immediately desist from taking any further provocative action. Kiev accuses Russian military of setting the stage for street fighting in Kherson ahead of an expected offensive by Ukraine to retake the city. The Ukrainian military says Russia is forcing civilians to leave the city, saying this amounts to war crime. The military also says Russian forces disguised in civilian clothes are plundering evacuated homes. Moscow denies the accusations. It says it's vacating the area to ensure the safety of the residents. Kherson is one of the eastern Ukrainian regions that Russia annexed after holding referendums there. The Ukrainian military is pushing counteroffensives to take back those regions and other Russian-held territory. Kiev's campaign has been propped up by Western arms. Ukraine now says it has received the first shipment of advanced surface-to-air missile systems pledged by Western countries. Eurozone finance ministers meet in Brussels to exchange views on the EU's worsening energy crisis. Governments in the bloc have so far failed to mitigate the economic costs associated with cutting off Russia's cheap gas supplies. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
It is blatantly obvious that Brussels is losing its energy war with Moscow as prices across the 19-country Eurozone continue to skyrocket. Washington is benefiting by selling gas to the EU at a high price. Eurozone finance ministers met on Monday to assess the crisis.
We are focusing now also within the European Commission, within the General Council, how we can, and then also with the ministers of energy that are focusing on how we can reduce that cost in the near future.
The poorest are feeling the pain most. Eye-watering amounts have been spent to try and compensate.
Euro area governments have so far collectively spent about 1.25% on energy supports for the year, so about 200 billion euro.
Of course, it's all linked to the EU's attempts to isolate Russia over the war in Ukraine. It's costing EU taxpayers billions of euro to house Ukrainian refugees, supply weapons to the Ukrainian army, and fund the government in Kiev. Ordinary workers will have to pay for it, but the Eurozone economy is beginning to flatline.
Inflation continues to be high, even surprisingly high for both Europe and the United States. Sentiment indicators are very low. indicating a risk of recession.
It appears the European Union is now in damage control mode.
I am telling that we can work, should work, to avoid that this is a prolonged period of recession.
Peace activists are calling on the EU to mediate between Russia and Ukraine, but those calls appear to be falling on deaf ears. Many people are now nervously wondering, is there an unemployment catastrophe looming in the Eurozone? Whether they are being overly pessimistic or merely realistic, there's no doubt a growing number of economists are suggesting the Eurozone is heading for a deep, prolonged recession. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Humanitarian organisations have denounced Italy for contravening international law by refusing to let in asylum seekers plucked from the Mediterranean Sea. This as rescue charities say they would take legal action against the Italian government.
A string of humanitarian groups have slammed the Italian government for breaking international law after pushing back over 200 asylum seekers who were trying to reach a safe port in Italy. Two rescue vessels, the Humanity One and the Gio Barents, had docked in Sicily on Sunday, carrying hundreds of asylum seekers. The most vulnerable ones, women, children and ill people, were allowed to disembark. But 35 men on the Humanity One and another 215 on the Gio Barents were told to stay on board. That was made possible by the Italian authorities hastily adopting a new decree which has introduced a selective approach in deciding who can disembark from the rescue boats. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni had put migration flows in the spotlight during her first trip to Brussels last week, when she asked the EU to help handle asylum seekers' arrivals on Italian coasts.
Our priorities are shifting. Italy's approach to migration will now be to defend its national borders. The matter is highly sensitive, but many EU leaders have agreed with me on this issue.
The Humanity One said it would launch legal action against the Italian government, claiming Rome's decision to not let all the asylum seekers disembark violates European law and the Geneva Refugee Convention. Meanwhile, two other boats run by non-governmental organizations remain at sea, with no ports willing to accept them. In 2017, the Italian government signed an EU-sponsored agreement with the Libyan government. The deal, which is still in place, provides that Italy and the EU help the Libyan Coast Guard enhance its maritime surveillance capacity by providing financial support and technical assets. In practical terms, under the deal, every asylum seeker intercepted at sea ends up in a Libyan detention center where torture, sexual violence and abuse are practiced.
The European member state and its citizens have been manipulated by few political heads. They do not know the facts, what is happening on the Mediterranean, what are the causes why people are forced to migrate. So when we tell this story, when we try to approach, when we try to unveil these realities, what is happening in the concentration camp in Libya, people will wake up.
Since the start of the year, about 180,000 asylum seekers have reached the EU on boats, up almost 90% compared to the year before. We are in the middle of the biggest mass migration in Europe since the end of World War II, and as distasteful as it may sound, that's also a huge business opportunity. An increasing number of people believe that refugee flows keep pouring into the old continent for the greed of those who exploit asylum seekers for profit in and outside Europe. Max Civili, Rome.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the Best of the Names. In the Name of Allah, Lord of Earth and Heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Leaders meeting with group of students. On Wednesday, 2nd of November 2022, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with hundreds of students on the occasion of National Students' Day. and a national day of fighting against global arrogance, which are commemorated in Iran both on the 4th of November each year. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. The 4th of November in the Islamic Republic of Iran has been designated as the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance. It is also Students' Day in Iran, and on Wednesday, 2nd of November, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, met with a large group of hundreds of students who sang a beautiful song for their leader. At this meeting, on Wednesday, 2nd of November 2022, Artin Saraydaran was the special guest of the leader. The mournful young child had lost three members of his family in the recent terrorist attack on Shah Cheragh in the city of Shiraz in southern Iran. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei started off by saying, "The first topic I want to talk about is 4th of November. Well, you have heard a lot about it. 4th of November is a historic day. It is both historic and educational. When we say it is a historic day, it means that on this day there were events that will be recorded forever in our history. These events cannot be forgotten, and they certainly should not be forgotten. They are educational because there have been reactions as a result of these events that serve as a lesson for us all." The leader poignantly added, "This day is an important day for us. But it also really agitates the Americans. This is a day that frustrates the Americans whenever it is commemorated. This meeting today angers the Americans. They will be agitated by it. But why? Because this day symbolizes the evil and pernicious influence of the United States and also is a symbol of American defeat. 4th of November proves that the Americans can be defeated." Knowing the enemy and the United States in particular tends to be a recurring theme in Ayatollah Khamenei's comments and remarks. From the point of view of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, the disagreements between Iran and the United States are deeply rooted and fundamental. From the leader's point of view, there is a huge gulf, a huge chasm, between US and Iranian politics and diplomacy, between US and Iranian beliefs, points of view, and historical experiences. The leader continued by saying, "Three historic events took place on 4th of November, some of which are directly related to the Americans, and others are indirectly related. One event was the exile of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, which took place on 4th of November 1964. Why was Imam Khomeini sent into exile? Because a law was ratified by direct orders of the Shah, and the parliament of those days rubber-stamped this law. According to that law, the Americans who lived in Iran were granted immunity from legal prosecution. According to this law, if an American national committed any sort of crime in Iran, they could not be legally prosecuted. So, for example, if an American happened to run someone over while driving a car, the judicial system in Iran had no right to prosecute them. Imam Khomeini did not tolerate this, of course. He gave a long speech. His voice recording and a text of his speech are available today. Because of this, he was sent into exile. This was an event that was directly related to the Americans. The second event on 4th of November was the killing of students. A number of children who were around your age were massacred, martyred in front of Tehran University. This sad event also took place on 4th of November 1978. just a few months before the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The third event, which took place exactly a year later, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, was the students' takeover of the American embassy in Tehran, what became known as a den of espionage. During that attack, many documents were found that revealed the United States' conspiracies against the Iranian nation. These documents show what the Americans were doing during the time they were in Iran, that is, from around 1949 or 1950 onwards. It shows their conspiracies and their acts of treason against the Iranian nation. Further comments, the leader referred to the American and British-backed coup d'etat of August of 1953. On 19th of August 1953, a national government was at work. Mohammad Mossadegh's government was a national government, and the issue he had with the West was about oil. Mossadegh was neither a cleric, nor did he claim to want Islam. It was just about oil. The country's oil was in the hands of the British. He said, "Our oil needs to be nationalized. We have to control our own oil resources." That was his only crime. The Americans staged a coup d'etat, a very bizarre coup d'etat. There are some vague things about that event in my mind. I was 14 years old at the time. I have read the history behind it, and I'm aware of the details. The Americans sat and conspired against Mossadegh and crafted a coup d'etat. Even though Mossadegh trusted the Americans, he trusted them, he even liked them. He thought that the US government would support him against the British, but they actually stabbed him in the back. Turning to the topic of US conspiracies and plots against Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei asked rhetorically, "Is there anything that you had the ability to do against the Iranian nation in the past four decades and that you haven't done? Whatever they didn't do was because they weren't able to do it, or because it didn't benefit them. They did whatever they were capable of doing. They supported separatist groups at the beginning of the revolution. They supported the coup d'etat attempt at Nojeh military base in Hamedan province. The Americans showed support for the blind terrorism of the Munafiqeen, the MKO terrorists, which led to the killing of thousands of martyrs across the nation. They supported the savage Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during the eight-year imposed war on Iran. They provided Saddam with weapons, intelligence information, and aid. The war was provoked by the Americans, and they were the ones who forced Saddam to initiate the eight-year war. The Americans shot down an Iranian passenger plane, a commercial airliner, over the skies of the Persian Gulf, which resulted in the death of over 300 innocent Iranians. And they did not express any regret or apologies afterwards. They even rewarded that criminal general who shot down the Iranian commercial plane. They honored him with a medal. This is how you have treated the Iranian people. You imposed sanctions on the Iranian nation since the first year of the Islamic Revolution. You imposed the most severe sanctions that history has ever witnessed in the last few years. They admitted this themselves. They also tried to fuel unrest and sedition in Iran. They fully supported the seditionists during the unrest of 2009. Prior to that, Barack Obama wrote to me saying the US wants to cooperate with Iran. Obama was in a sense swearing that they did not wish to overthrow us. However, as soon as the sedition of 2009 began, they started to support it, in the hope that the sedition might go somewhere and bring the Iranian nation to its knees. They wanted to overthrow the Islamic Republic. This is how you treated the Iranian nation. Thank you. In further remarks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution referred to America's assassination of the top Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani. The leader said, "You Americans openly declared that you killed our fearless general. You murdered him, and you were proud of it, and you announced that you gave the orders." Marta Soleimani was not just a national hero, he was a regional hero. Marta Soleimani played a major and unparalleled role in solving the problems of several countries in this region. "You martyred this great man and his companions, Marta Abu Mahdi al-Muhandes and several others. You supported the Zionists, the Israeli regime, which assassinated our nuclear scientists. The Israeli regime martyred our scientists one by one, and you supported them. Not only did you fail to condemn them, but you actually supported them. You have frozen billions of dollars of the Iranian nation's assets in the United States and in other countries. If this money was at the disposal of the hard-working Iranian government, like the current government, it would be able to do great things with it. But you have frozen these assets and you're keeping them. This excludes the assets that were frozen in the United States since the beginning of the Islamic Revolution. America's fingerprints can be seen in most anti-Iranian events, and they claim that they empathize with the Iranian nation. They said this again yesterday, that they sympathize with the Iranian nation. They are, of course, lying. This is complete insolence. Of course, they have shown great hostility towards us, but the Iranian nation, getting the better of them, has thwarted many of these hostilities. Some of these events are still with us. We have not forgotten them. We will never forget the martyrdom of the great general Qasem Soleimani. They know this. We have said some things about this, and we stand by our word. Well, the America of today is the same America of yesterday. The America of today is the same America of August of 1953. It is the same America that helped the Iraqi dictator Saddam. It is the same America of the past few years, with one or two important differences which we must pay attention to. First of all, the enemy's tactics have become more complex. We need to pay attention to this. The hostilities remain the same, but the method of applying these enmities is different and more complex. It is not easy to untie the knots. You need to pay attention. You need to be alert. Of course, we trust our own children, our own youth, and our own officials. We know they're capable of dealing with things that are complicated, but it is complex. This is one difference. Secondly, that day in August of 1953, and even until the beginning of the Islamic Revolution, the US was the dominant power in the world, but that is not the case today. This is one important difference. Today, the United States is not the world's dominant power. Many of the world's political analysts believe that the US is declining. It is gradually fading away. We aren't the only ones to say this, of course. We have the same opinion, but the world's political analysts are also saying it. The signs are evident. The United States' domestic problems are unprecedented in the economic, social, and moral spheres, as well as their internal conflicts and the bloodstained divisions inside the country. In further remarks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution said, "One of the things that I'm saying this now, and some other people across the world have also said it, I believe that one of the signs of Americans' decline is the election of people like the current and former president of the United States. A country of 300 million plus people, almost destroys itself and elects a president in the previous term, somebody like Donald Trump, whom the world considers to be crazy. And after he was defeated, a man like this current president comes to power. And well, you know the stories about him. This is evidence of the decline of a nation. This is evidence of the decline of a civilization. So, this really matters, and it is related to America." The United States also played an obvious role in the recent riots that took place in our country in the past few weeks. The announcement made by Iran's intelligence ministry and the IRGC intelligence organization is a very important announcement. In concluding remarks at the end of his speech, the leader of the Islamic Revolution talked about Iran's role in the new world order. The leader said, "What is Iran's role in this new order? Where will Iran be placed? What position will our dear country hold? This is the thing that you need to think about. This is what you need to prepare yourselves for. This is the thing that the Iranian youth can work on. We can have an outstanding position in this new world order. We really can. Why? Because our country has outstanding features that many other countries lack. First of all, we have very talented human resources. We have really good human resources. The intelligence and talent of young Iranians is higher than average intelligence and talent the world over. Today, we are seeing the outcomes of intelligence and talents of those who were born in the 1980s and 1990s. The young people and those who are making innovations and updates in various scientific and technological fields are allowing the country to rank among the top 4 or 5 in the world in a number of disciplines. These are the same people who were born in the 1980s and the 1990s. Their effort is really bearing fruit today."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's programme, we'll be going behind the scenes of the newly unified resistance to the Zionist entity. We'll be examining the new Lion's Den resistance group, and we'll look at the framework of support for the resistance from outside Palestine. We'll be hearing from experts to find out more after this special report by Latifa Abouchakra on the rise of these new resistance groups in occupied Palestine.
A new resistance group announced its formation in August, the Lion's Den of Nablus. It has issued a stream of statements and has called for a massive mobilization against the occupation. The Lion's Den showcases a new unity in the Palestinian resistance factions, as it includes Fatah, as well as Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hamas, and the PFLP. This is both symbolically and practically important, as Nablus is a Fatah stronghold. We have even seen some Palestinian security personnel engaging in the armed resistance, ignoring and directly challenging the Fatah and Palestinian Authority leadership. The PA is being pressured into doing the bidding of the occupation, and this is driving more of a wedge between it and the Palestinian people. Since the emergence of the Lion's Den, other parts of the West Bank have followed suit and launched their own Lion's Den groups, or in one case, a Falcon's Nest. In a statement in October, they said, "We bring to you the news of the activation of a Falcon's Nest brigade cell in Qalqiyya, and what is coming is greater." Qalqiyya is also traditionally a Fatah stronghold. The context of this new unity is that since 1993, the number of settlers in the West Bank has almost tripled. In May, Israel embarked on a new operation to counter the rise of the attacks, called Break the Wave. The operation would focus on repairing the separation wall and fighting the rise of resistance groups in Jenin refugee camps and Nablus, not least through large-scale arrest campaigns. In the first half of October, the Israeli military conducted 145 search and arrest operations and arrested 127 Palestinians, including 13 children, across the West Bank. At the same time, Israel faced an increasing number of resistance operations, up to 19 in 2020 to 98 in 2021. This year, and until the end of September, there have already been around 130 attacks. The Lion's Den has taken heavy casualties, including the heart-stopping footage of Oday El-Tamimi being martyred following almost a fortnight on the run. But it also reported that a significant number of occupation force casualties resulted from a raid on Nablus in late October, none of which are referred to in the Zionist press. The new coordinated generation of Palestinian resistance fighters has forced the occupiers to recognize they cannot simply attack with impunity. The occupiers appear to be panicking. The former head of Shin Bet, the Zionist Internal Intelligence Agency, stated in the Zionist press on the 22nd of October, "We are on the brink of a civil war. The Zionist entity is standing on the edge of the abyss, an abyss of internal, social, and national disintegration. This is the real existential threat." As the Lion's Den has repeatedly said, current events will answer the question of who is besieging who.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Nadine Keswani, who's a Palestinian organiser from New York City. She's the founder and chair of Within Our Lifetime, United for Palestine. This is a Palestinian-led community-based group whose goal is to revitalise the revolutionary spirit of Palestinians living abroad in pursuit of a free homeland. She's also a student at the City University of New York School of Law, where she organises with Students for Justice in Palestine. And Nadine is a top target for the Zionist movement's racist, defamatory and harassment campaigns in the United States. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. What's the history of the unification of the resistance? For example, why was the May 2021 Unity Intifada so described?
Well, what we saw in May 2021, people might remember, is that there was a big issue around access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And increasingly, the settlers were being allowed access to the mosque. And also, there was a lot of pressure on areas in East Jerusalem, house demolitions, evictions of Palestinians. And that led to a kind of upswelling of anger and of resistance, which cut across normal political divisions. And so people got together and were united in a way which had not been the case for some years prior to that. And that's why it was called the Unity Intifada. And we see that spirit today in what seems to be the new Intifada of people acting across the established political factions to work together to resist the occupation.
Yeah. Dean, what's the significance, in your opinion, of this statement saying that there's no political project stroke process for the Palestinians?
You know, I think that we've seen over the past few years and few decades, actually, that there is no political process for Palestinians because, the peace talks have failed. Israel's continuously building settlements, killing Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank en masse, and there is no accurate political representative that is actually holding Israel accountable. The Palestinian Authority is not holding Israel accountable, is not representing the aspirations or the desires of the Palestinian people. In fact, they are collaborating with the Zionist entity, and I think that that's something that we're going to touch up on more. But for many Palestinians, we're not seeing any diplomatic or any other way for us to achieve our liberation, for us to achieve rights or even basic human dignity. So the significance of this statement is that because of all of the oppression that Palestinians have been under for over 70 years, the only political process that we've ever seen be effective is through resistance. And we've seen the resistance lead us, you know, through the Intifada and get us even a seat at the table to begin with. And of course, Oslo was disastrous. I'm not saying that, you know, these peace talks would have brought us peace, but the farcity of them does not even exist anymore. Israel doesn't even pretend to care about the two-state solution or any sort of diplomacy. And we don't have any elected leadership that truly represents our desire for right of return and full liberation of Palestinian land from the river to the sea, except for ourselves, except for, you know, political parties maybe that are considered by the U.S. and Israel to be quote-unquote terrorist groups and not legitimate government representatives. Yeah. So that's how I see it.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Nadine. I mean, David, what do you think explains the huge increase in resistance operations in the current year?
Well, I think coming from what Nadine's just been saying, I mean, there is no political process. There is only the possibility of liberation or death. And that's what we see here. We see the huge upswelling of operations, operations which are overwhelming the occupation forces themselves, as they have been saying. Huge increase every day in armed actions across the West Bank. This is not about Gaza, this is about the West Bank in particular, and you see a huge increase in resistance, meaning that there's been a lot more fighters engaged than previously, including fighters from Fatah, the faction which runs the Palestinian Authority. That's led to significant splits and debates inside the Palestinian Authority.
Mm. Indeed. And Nadine, I wonder what you could tell us about the Lion's Den and how it's emerged, and how does it relate, do you think, to previous innovations like the Jenin Brigades?
The Lion's Den emerged as a form of protection for the Palestinian people, especially, you know, in a city like Nablus and many other Palestinian cities, which regularly face raids, incursions, which are regularly under siege. You know, people's homes being demolished, people are assassinated constantly. So the Lion's Den and, you know, similar innovations like the Jenin Brigades, as you mentioned, are really a form of protection for the Palestinian people when there is no one to protect us, when the Palestinian Authority doesn't protect us because they are collaborating with the Zionist entity. So it has emerged because Palestinians are taking matters into their own hands. And we've mentioned the May 2021 Unity Intifada earlier, which really brought Palestinians together in an unprecedented way in recent years. And I think that was the start of what led to the Lion's Den, this hope and reemergence of self-determination, of taking matters into your own hands. You know, as Arab countries continue to normalize around us, we know that nobody's going to give us our liberation. And, you know, the main people that are going to fight for it are ourselves. So it's emerged as a form of protection for the people of those cities, but also as a form of resistance and not just self-defense, actually actively resisting the occupation every day. So, you know, I think that this is going to be continuous until all of Palestine is free, wherever there is oppression or oppression that breeds resistance. And, you know, innovations like the Lion's Den, even if it's wiped out tomorrow, as we see Israel continuously assassinating the leaders and members of the Lion's Den, innovations like that will continue to pop up as long as we live under occupation, siege, blockade, and, you know, all forms of Zionist settler colonialism and apartheid.
David, let me turn to you again and ask you, what would you say the significance is of the PIJ statement about Fatah when they said, and I'll quote a part of it, they said, "There's nothing between us and the Fatah that resists, that fights. But the Fatah that constitutes the Palestinian Authority have sold themselves to the American project.
Well, here's a very clear statement that the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement is not trying to recruit people from the Palestinian Authority to make their organization bigger. They're saying, no, there is a Fatah which is our ally, which is our comrade, which is the Fatah which fights, which resists. But the Fatah which collaborates with the American project, that is the Fatah which is the opponent of liberation and resistance. So there's a clear split going on inside the Fatah family, if you like. And we've seen that with the Lion's Den and with other similar organizations, where some of the fighters who have been at the forefront of the resistance have been people from Fatah. And of course, what's happened then is that there's been pressure put on the Palestinian Authority to pressure those people who would formerly have been close comrades of the Palestinian Authority people. So there's a really difficult process going on there of a split of key parts of the authority of Fatah people coming over to the resistance.
Well, thanks for that. We're going to just pause there for a moment to have a look at this report on the challenges faced by the resistance and the external forces coming to its aid.
As a new intifada rumbles in the West Bank, crucial decisions are being taken and actions made which will affect the likely success of the uprising. A major threat to the resistance is the Palestinian Authority, which collaborates shamelessly with the Zionists. The PA has been exerting maximum pressure on the resistance in close collaboration with the Zionists. Direct death threats to resistance fighters coming from the occupation, with the PA then offering a seeming way out through job offers in the PA security forces. Meanwhile, footage emerged from TikTok of PA security escorting an illegal settler who got lost back to the occupation. Days later, reports also emerged that Mohammed Albana, the brother of the Lion's Den leader Mahmoud Albana, was tortured to death by the PA. A cache of documents has been leaked on the Palestinian Authority, allegedly showing collaboration of elements of the PA in the death of leader Yasser Arafat. The anniversary of his death is the 11th of November. But the more pressure the settler regime puts on the PA, the more the PA may split apart and fighters are recruited from Fatah to the resistance. As support builds internally, the unity of the resistance is being bolstered by external support. In recent months, the newly unified resistance has overseen rapprochement between Hamas, specifically, and the Syrian Arab Republic, after differences over the Western proxy war against the Syrian government. Here is Hamas Political Bureau member Khalil Al-Khaya speaking in Damascus.
Syria, its people and leadership, all of whom embraced the Palestinian people and were supporters of the resistance. In this heartfelt meeting, we touched upon the president's determination with firm conviction to provide support from Syria to the Palestinian people and their resistance with all capabilities.
A crucial additional dimension to support for the resistance is the central role of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In a major interview on Al Jazeera on October 23rd, Zaid al-Nakala, Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad Movement in Palestine, stated clearly, Iran is an ally to PIJ and the Palestinian people. It shows solidarity and supports every faction of the Palestinian people. Iran is clear in its stance against Israel and America. Although Iran had the choice to be selfish and think of only defending itself, it continuously provides support to our cause. Iran also provides military support and strategic expertise to the resistance forces, and Hamas enjoys the lion's share of their support. Iran only has honest intentions in aiding us with our liberation.
David, the film there seemed to suggest that the Palestinian Authority is up to its neck in collaboration with the Israeli regime. Don't you say that's a fair characterization?
I'm afraid it is. I mean, the authority itself is deeply involved in Israeli security apparatus. And what you've been seeing in recent weeks in Nablus and other areas is that the Israelis threaten individual fighters with death, and then the Palestinian Authority goes in, contacts them, and sometimes meets with these people and offers them jobs in the PA security apparatus. And so it's a coordinated strategy where there's a very, very close collaboration between the Israelis and the Palestinian Authority. And of course, that's a really problematic issue, especially given many of the people in the Fatah faction are joining and are involved in the resistance.
Indeed. I mean, Nadine, how would you describe the role of the Palestinian Authority in the current circumstances?
Unfortunately, the Palestinian Authority continues to collaborate with Israel, as I mentioned earlier. And there have actually been recent reports of members of the Lions then surrendering themselves to the Palestinian Authority, which, you know, we don't know how that's going to turn out. But we've seen in the past, you know, resistance figures and fighters who are actively fighting for the liberation of Palestine being undermined by the Palestinian Authority, imprisoned, beaten up, and even killed. So we know where their loyalties lie. They are heavily funded by the U.S. They collaborate with the U.S. and Israel, and they're influenced by that. And they wouldn't be in power if they weren't, to be frank, because we know that there's no such thing as actual democratic elections in Palestine, because when the U.S. and Israel and other countries don't like the result, they'll just form a coup. So, you know, I think that we haven't had elections in over 10 years. And at this point, the Palestinian Authority is less concerned with actually representing